And we're back here on Unusual Sources, 93.3 CFMU FM, broadcasting to Hamilton on the FM dial at 93.3 and also to the rest of the world at cfmu.mcmaster.ca. And as promised, we have today with us live on air, we have Zafar Bangash, Islamic scholar, journalist, and community leader in Toronto, Greater Toronto Area. And we're very pleased that he can join us today after a long break. There's a lot of updates and a lot of news. Zafar, thanks so much for being here with us today.
It's my great pleasure, Brandon.
Well, you know, it's been a few weeks, and there's been so much happening. Every day is like a week in the Middle East, in Central Asia. I know you have been trying to catch up on things and be at the forefront, bring us knowledge, and tell us what's going on. And you've been on some trips recently. I understand you've just returned to Canada. Where were you traveling?
Yes, actually, I had gone to South Africa.
Yes.
And funnily enough, it was there was a conference, but more importantly for me, it was the launch of two of my new books. You know, I've a week before that, we did the launch of one of the books, which is in fact a major title, about 400 pages. It's a very academic book. It's about the letters and treaties of the Prophet and how it established peace and justice in society. And I looked into these letters, treaties. In fact, there is one particular chapter which our friends in South Africa liked so much that they want to publish that separately, which is referred to as the Covenant of Medina. That is basically a constitution that, you know, when the Prophet Muhammad, the peace be upon him, migrated from Mecca to Medina, he established a written constitution. And this is the first written constitution in the world. And it's incredible that, you know, in a society that was not known for doing things in writing, because writing was not a particularly strong skill at that time, society was governed essentially by tribal customs and traditions, and yet here was a written constitution given to the people in which the rights of all people, regardless of their religion, were recognized in writing and respected in writing. And so it was, you know, our friends in South Africa felt that that needed to be highlighted, so they published that particular chapter, which came to about 100, 112 pages, separately. So basically my trip was to launch the original book, the main book, the 400-page book, which is titled Power Manifestations of the Seerah, Examining the Letters and Treaties of the Messenger of Allah. Now, of course, you know, Seerah means the biography of the Prophet. And so that is the main book that, as I mentioned, we had launched here in Toronto before I left for South Africa. And then I went to attend a conference as well as have the launch of my two books. So it went very well. But at the same time, as you mentioned, there was so much happening in the world, and there still is so much happening in the world that one needs to catch up with it. And, of course, the most important story of the last couple of weeks has been this absolute slaughter that occurred in Norway, this act of terrorism perpetrated by this fellow by the name of Breivik, who's a right-wing Christian fundamentalist inspired by, you know, a lot of Islamophobes in North America as well as in Britain. And also, incidentally, influenced by Zionist ideology that feeds into Islamophobia. So essentially, that definitely is a major story, and I think we ought really to talk about.
Yeah, there's some things going on in the story that might surprise some of our listeners, although perhaps not us, because some of the issues we've been warning about and discussing for literally years on this program have come to fruition or come to light as a result of this terrorist incident. And I use the word terrorist because this is something that gets me. As soon as I heard of the attacks, it was that Friday, I went to the CNN website and it said, terrorist attacks in Oslo in Norway. And I thought, oh no, here it comes. There's going to be all sorts of Islamophobic rhetoric, attacks on Muslims. And sure enough, when I went to CNN's comments page, where people can submit comments on the news stories, it was just 100 pages, literally dozens, page after page after page of racist comments, blaming Muslims, blaming Islam, saying, basically people were saying, see, I told you so, we need to be more aware of the dangers of Islam, and so on. So this went on, this sort of Tea Party rhetoric, this Koch brothers-inspired trolling, and I wanted to see what was happening on the television, so I tuned into Sun TV, because there had been a demonstration earlier that day. I was wondering if Sun TV was going to cover it. What I saw instead was their so-called news and commentary programming at 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock. They immediately went on to the issue, and they brought in what they called a terrorism expert or a security expert. He said, well, there's two possibilities of what happened today. Number one, it could have been right-wing extremists, or number two, it could have been Islamic terrorists. And then he immediately launched into a discussion about the possibilities of Islamic terrorism. There's very little discussion of the right-wing extremism. So what he said was, well, the guests, the hosts on Sun TV were asking him, why did this happen? Why are they attacking us? You know, the old, why do you hate us kind of thing. And the guest said, well, you know, it's because we are prosperous and we're doing better than them. And we're wealthy and they're jealous. And he literally said, because we're better than them. And so, of course, eventually that story and that reporting had to change once the true facts of the event came to light. How did you initially respond when you heard about this news?
Well, very similar to what you have just described. I was in South Africa, in Pretoria, in fact, and when the news broke, naturally, we immediately turned to television, and the way you have described, that's exactly how it was coming through, whether it was CNN or even Al Jazeera, as it was covering, and the BBC, because we were monitoring all the networks at the time, and the initial reports all were, Islamic terrorists, et cetera, that kind of nonsense. And when I could immediately flip back to April of 1994, when the Oklahoma City bombing occurred, which was Timothy McVeigh that had bombed the Alfred Murrah building, in which 168 people were killed. And I recall Steve Emerson, one of these American Islamophobes, who was immediately on the air on CBS, and he described that bombing as the hallmarks of Islamic terrorists. And of course, when it was revealed that it wasn't Muslims who were involved, but in fact a homegrown right-wing Christian fundamentalists involved in this, then the tone changed. And exactly the same thing happened here. So initially it was all talk about terrorism, but when it was discovered that it wasn't any Muslims involved, but in fact a Norwegian Christian Zionist who was behind this thing, then they didn't mention terrorism. Then it just became, he was just immediately branded as a lunatic. So, if a Christian Zionist does something like that, then he becomes immediately a lunatic. And you would have noticed, and your listeners would have noticed, that there has been very little reporting of his background and his links. There is more emphasis on the victims of this carnage.
Yes, you've brought to light two very important issues here. The first is, obviously, they don't use the word terrorist to describe him anymore. It was only terrorism when they thought Muslims were doing it. So now they might use the word extremist, but mostly they'll just call him a lone insane person. So there's a cartoon that's been going around highlighting this, which it says, when bin Laden kills people, people accuse him of doing it on behalf of all Muslims. But when this Breivik kills people, he's just acting alone. And we know that's not true, because the other thing is, he is acting in representation of a philosophy, of a political philosophy, of an ideology, and a movement that's formed, especially in the last 10 years and longer. And you say Zionist affiliations, and this is what, one of the reasons we have this program, because you're going to get actual reporting here that the media is not really picking up on very well. what they know, if you read some of the media commentary, they'll say that they were surprised to learn that the terrorist was very pro-Israel, that he was very much a supporter of Israel, and of course very much a supporter of the U.S. war on terror and so forth. And they said this is a new thing, that they were having difficulty understanding why it is that this terrorist, who is anti-Muslim and a fascist, would also be supporting Israel. And although he himself did not appear to be a friend of the Jewish people and made numerous racist statements in his giant manifesto, he also saw himself as part of an agenda, a sort of a Western agenda. So that plays also into his various right-wing links. What can you tell us about...
Exactly. Yeah. You see, you're right that these kinds of right-wing Christian Zionists, etc., they're also anti-Jewish. This is the incredible thing. And you can see that, the island that he attacked, Utoya Island, where the youth were camping, actually the youth had a banner there which said, boycott Israel. Again, you would find very little mention of that in any of the media coverage. In fact, if one reads his 1,500-page manifesto, he quotes extensively from the American Islamophobes, Robert Spencer, Daniel Pipes, Pam Geller, and even our own Mark Stein here in Canada. And I think it is something that people ought to pay attention to, that these people have all been trying to now distance themselves from this terrorist in Norway.
Oh, yes. It's something we should pay a lot of attention to, because if you go onto some of these right-wing sites like Little Green Footballs, it seems to me at least that now they're all trying to point the finger at each other and accuse each other of being responsible for inciting this person. So they'll say, it wasn't my blog that caused this. It was your blog because you featured what might have been his comments. And so now there's this finger-pointing going on because this guy had been posting. He'd been involved with the English Defense League.
Yes.
He had been involved with various Scandinavian fascist parties. He had been making overtures towards the Tea Party. He had been following all of the Islamophobic anti-immigration people. And that was his movement. That was his base, this anti-Islam thing. And people are trying to understand, Where does this idea come from? Where does his ideology come from? And what's really interesting, as someone noted in one of the first articles on the subject, is that on the first day, on the Friday, on day one, when we heard about this incident, there had been all the accusations directed against Muslims. And if you went to these right-wing forums, as soon as they learned it was Breivik, they shut up, because it turns out, his ideology was the same as a great deal of these right-wing anti-Islamic commentators. So the same people that were blaming Islam and getting mad at Muslims for this, they shared an ideology with Breivik. And you can go right to Glenn Beck's comments. Because I believe, number one, he said that because they were the kids, the children, and some of the adults that were murdered, they were part of the Social Democratic Party, the Socialist Party, and had all these affiliations. He said they were like Hitler Youth. So he said that the victims of Breivik were like Hitler Youth.
Can you imagine? Victims are now being blamed for the terrorist acts of this person, Breivik. It's interesting. I was just reading on this that people like Spencer and Geller and Horowitz, David Horowitz, they've actually tried to capitalize on this and say that they've sent out emails to their supporters to say that we need you to help us so that we can defend free speech, that we are now being attacked and being held responsible for, in their words, this lunatic, this lone lunatic who has nothing to do with us, but we are advocating free speech, and we have to defend America from Muslims taking over. This is the line that they are giving in their interpretation.
Oh, yes, and that was confirmed on the Friday, the day of, because I believe even on the Canadian TV commentators, along with the right-wing blogs, when they were looking at Muslims, trying to accuse Muslims of this, they said, why did they do this? Why did they attack Norway? Well, not only does Norway have the higher standard of living, as was discussed, but also the Danish cartoons, that right. the Muslims, or the Islamists, or the Islamic jihadists, that was the word used on Sun TV about 5,000 times on Friday, Islamic jihadists, attacked Norway because of the Danish cartoons. So to them, that vindicated their idea that the Islamic movement was going to attack free speech because of the Danish cartoon controversy.
Exactly. I think out of all of this, what we really need to learn and to internalize is that this hate campaign against Muslims is not going to target only Muslims, it's going to engulf everybody. And this situation has come so tragically that these innocent people that were brutally murdered in Norway for doing nothing more than simply going about their business and being, you know, trying to lead a normal life, and yet this terrorist mindset that has been bred by this great wave of Islamophobic intolerance and exaggerated claims that are being made. In the U.S., we see, for instance, there are several states that have passed laws to ban Sharia. I mean, you know, one should ask them, who is bringing Sharia into the U.S.? And which Muslims have asked for the implementation of Sharia in this society?
Yes.
And yet, you know, state legislatures have actually passed laws to ban the use of Sharia. I mean, it is incredible. It's like, you know, if we were to extend it further, we could say, well, look, are they going to suggest that, for instance, Jewish people should not resort to Jewish law to administer their lives, whether it refers to their dietary laws or marriage arrangements or whatever, or that Christians should not have the right to have marriages according to the Christian tradition?
Yes.
Or church conduct church services according to Christian tradition?
Only Muslims are being targeted.
Exactly.
And you can look in France and other countries in Europe where the laws that are being enacted are punitive laws against Muslims. So
yes.
They're about wearing headscarves and hijabs and so on. They're about the placement of mosques. That also came into the United States debate about the so-called World Trade Center mosque,
yeah.
And so on. So in Europe and in the United States, the measures enacted are against Muslims and then not other religions, although other religions get caught up in the racist hysteria,
yeah.
Like the 9/11 revenge attacks in the U.S. Occurred against people of Indian descent, Hindu descent, and other groups because
right.
They were believed to be Muslim by ignorant racists. So this it explodes very quickly, and you're right that this is not an isolated incident. If there's one thing we can take away from this attack in Norway, it's that this is not an isolated incident. And there was a great article today by Max Blumenthal, and what he was saying was, you know, the right-wing anti-Islamic hysteria, you know, the climate of fear created a soil from which Breivik could grow, this homegrown terrorist. So, you know, he was not acting alone. What he was doing was enacting physically the values that had been inculcated into him by this sort of these racist movements. And
exactly.
And for the most part, people in the West, as we're hinting at here, most people have not felt it necessary to engage in these attacks because they're already being conducted. This is the Samuel Huntington clash of civilizations ideology. The idea that there's a battle between Christian West and Muslim East is being implemented in part through the war in Afghanistan, the attack on Pakistan, the bombings against Yemen, and so forth. You know, in the West, NATO, the United States military, the Canadian bombs are enacting this agenda through uniformed soldiers. So the terrorist attacks conducted by extremists here in the West are secondary in nature to this larger state-sanctioned violence.
Exactly. I think it is very important that people realize and understand that this kind of hate-filled ideology is not going to leave anybody unaffected and untouched. It will affect all of us, and I think it is extremely important to step back from spreading this hate ideology and targeting any particular group. As we know, you know, in the 30s and 40s, the Jewish people were targeted in Europe with horrible consequences. And I think today that is now being turned on Muslims in Europe and in North America. And again, we are going to see horrible consequences not only for Muslims, but it is going to affect all segments of society. And so it is extremely important that we guard against this, and that instead of spreading hatred and intolerance and spreading absolute lies, that I think we ought to be working towards building bridges of understanding. We all have different, you know, perceptions of life, but that is what a democratic society is all about, that you respect the differences, you don't demean others' values just because you happen to disagree with them, but that we can disagree without being disagreeable to each other. And so it is a very important lesson that we take from this tragedy, and indeed it is a tragedy for all the victims and their families, and our sympathies definitely are with them. But at the same time, we need to learn, and we all need to step back rather than spreading this hate, ideology of hate against Muslims, because it's going to consume everybody.
Yes.
And we have seen the results of that. So it is very important that we not fall for this, and that we take stock of the situation before other tragedies like this occur.
I think this is the rational and humane prescription. And sadly, if you read Breivik's manifesto, the types of accusations he makes against Muslims and his influences make against Muslims are similar to the accusations that were made against Jewish people in the 1930s. So
exactly.
It's a very dangerous ideology. And as you say, it's going to touch everyone. Already, Breivik thought it was acceptable to kill his fellow Norwegians, social democrats, people on the left, because he saw them as traitors. And this kind of right-wing terrorism has been a danger in the past, and it's going to continue to be a danger. We need to hold hands and say enough to this violence. And the Norwegian government has at times made a decent response to this, saying we're not going to let our society be changed and twisted and warped by these kind of attacks, and we can't give in to these threats, and we need to keep up the spirit of understanding. And I think in this coverage, in this discussion, you mentioned Al Jazeera and how it had been a little disappointing in the initial coverage, and I guess that's not the only place where it's been disappointing, because I know with the war on Libya, we would have expected that we could get multiple views from our news sources, that Al Jazeera would give us the kind of critical and contrasting coverage we've come to expect on Libya. That hasn't really been the case. And if you look into the issue, we've discussed this briefly before, but Al Jazeera is based in Qatar, and Qatar has, it would seem, special interests on Libya. And I just found an article it was in Business Weekly, and it was about how Qatar stands to gain big from the war on Libya, and it talks about how the rebels wear Qatar-supplied desert uniforms. There's billboards from Qatar. There's the flag of Qatar, which has been flying at the rebel headquarters. Qatar has set up a field hospital. They fly in aid. It goes on and on and on and on. What is Qatar doing? Why is it involved in this capacity in Libya?
Well, Qatar is a tiny country, but it's obviously trying to punch above its weight in not only Middle Eastern politics, but also global politics. And it feels that it has found an opportunity where it can rub shoulders with major international players. So Qatar is one of a few Middle Eastern countries that have joined this incredibly barbaric attack on Libya. And although this is done under the pretext of saving Libyan civilians, but we know that far from saving Libyan civilians, NATO bombs are actually killing civilians. And I want to mention, I had mentioned this before as well, that before the March 17th Security Council resolution was passed, the Arab League had met at the instigation of Saudi Arabia, another conservative, backward monarchy like Qatar, a tribal monarchy. And Saudi Arabia had instigated the meeting of the Arab League. Now, there are 22 members of the Arab League, but only 12 of them showed up to that meeting. And even out of those 12, 9 of them supported a resolution to impose a no-fly zone on Libya. Now, the Libyan government immediately complied with the no-fly zone resolution, although it was a direct assault on its sovereignty, because there is an uprising, an armed uprising in the country, and it has a lot to do with tribal divisions. It has a lot to do with how the country's assets and resources are utilized. And none of these other countries that have joined the attack on Libya are doing any better. And yet, here was a number of Arab countries, including Qatar, that joined the assault on Libya. But now we have discovered that NATO attacks have gone way beyond the original Security Council resolution, because, first of all, Libya is not using any aircrafts or aerial vehicles to attack the rebels that are heavily armed. So NATO is actually now bombing Tripoli, civilian areas, hotels, people's homes. Cynthia McKinney, who has been in Libya, who was in Libya for many weeks, she sent several reports from there giving first-hand accounts of how hotels were bombed, how people's homes were bombed, how civilians were killed, and yet people still came out in Tripoli in defiance of NATO bombings, and they said that we will continue to resist this Western attack and invasion of our country. Now, of course, the West has other objectives in attacking Libya, which go beyond simply control of oil. It is also because Libya has refused to join the Bank of International Settlements. That means that Libyan financial policies and monetary policies are not controlled from outside the country. The Libyan Central Bank determines those policies. Secondly, Libya had floated the idea of setting up an African Monetary Fund for which $42 billion were to be set aside, and Libya had set aside $30 billion of that, and that money was actually in the U.S., and as soon as this NATO assault on Libya started, the U.S. froze those $30 billion of Libyan assets. In fact, Libya has about $185 billion in assets deposited in Western banks, all of which have been frozen. And the third aspect, of course, was that Colonel Gaddafi had proposed setting up a gold dinar that would be used as a currency for the whole of Africa. And again, that was something that the West was not prepared to accept, as well as its allies in the Middle East, countries like Saudi Arabia, Qatar, etc., because they have large dollar reserves. And so if a gold dinar had been set up in which African countries would trade with each other, it would have had two consequences. Number one, it would have weakened the dollar as well as the euro because reserve currencies would no longer have been kept in that. And secondly, the vast natural resources of Africa would then have been put out of reach of the Western countries. And so those were the factors that have actually led to this Western assault on Libya and the fact that you know, these rebels, as soon as they took control of Benghazi, one of their first acts was to set up a central bank. Now, you would wonder, if there are people in the middle of a war, and they call that the war of liberation, if it's a war of liberation, setting up a central bank would be the last thing on their minds at that time. And yet, funnily enough, that's what they are doing over there.
That sounds outrageous. I had heard about that central bank, but I didn't know all the full details of that Arab League meeting. So thanks for bringing that to our attention. You know, Al Jazeera hasn't given us this kind of reporting. You have. I guess Press TV is the new Al Jazeera, if you want to get the opposing view or
exactly,
an opposing view.
Exactly, yes. And also, you know, we have given all of this information on our website, which people can access, which is crescent-online.net. They can get all of this information because we have covered it extensively to provide the context in which all of these things are occurring so that people have a better understanding of the reality rather than simply, you know, rattling on about denouncing Colonel Gaddafi as a dictator or as a tyrant. Because, you know, the Middle East is full of tyrants, so what's so special about Gaddafi? And you know, when you look at what he was trying to do, then you begin to understand why the West is so exercised about some of his moves.
Yes.
But one final point I want to mention, that the rebels themselves are now fighting among themselves. Last week, in fact last Thursday, one of the rebel commanders, Abdul Fattah Yunus, was shot dead by some soldiers, and I think there is a great deal of turmoil over there because his particular tribe has said that unless the perpetrators of this crime are apprehended and punished, then if they don't do it, then there's going to be fighting among them. So I think this looks like the beginning of an internal conflict within the rebel movement as well. And I think that would mean that all of these attempts that were made, all of this propaganda that the rebels were going to succeed, etc., it appears increasingly unlikely, because they're beginning to start to fight among themselves.
No, absolutely. It's breaking apart, and that transitional council was never representative. It was NATO imposed. We'll see more about these internal issues as we go on. Crescent International provides coverage not only on the issues we've discussed, but also on Yemen and what the United States has been doing there, Pakistan, Afghanistan, everything we haven't been able to fully cover this week. So we're going to have to catch up with you, I guess, because we ran out of time. There's more to discuss. So
sure.
we're going to check in with you. We should direct our listeners to check out Crescent-Online.net, because there is this excellent commentary on there, the stuff that Al Jazeera and CNN would like you to forget about. So we can thank Zafar for bringing it to our attention. We're going to follow up on this because Zafar at Crescent Online are doing the work. They're doing the reporting. They're giving us alternate views, and they need to be respected. We need to get more of that. Zafar, thanks so much for being with us today.
It's my great pleasure, Brandon.
It was a pleasure here, too. Thanks,
Zafar.
Thank you, bye-bye. Of course, Zafar Bengash in Toronto.